Let's do it.
To the right, 5 seconds to go in the first half. Dante fires deep to the left. Moss caught it at the 11, but now he pitches
look at
it.
This.
Demole Williams, touchdown!
You gotta be kidding me!
All right, we are back with another episode of the Climbing the Pocket podcast. I am your host, Jason Brown. You can find me on Twitter at BrownJason. And as always, not always, but most of the time, on the good nights, we got the full crew with us here. Action-packed episode, but we're going to start with some introductions first. QB1, JR. Movie Critic 1, JR. What's going on, my man?
What's going on, man? A little bit under the weather, but I'm here. I'm good. I'm ready to go.
Okay, a man's playing hurt tonight. Man's playing hurt. And the man and the world. We'll expand it now. The world's number one puppy parent. Miles Gorham, what's going on, my man? How's Teddy doing?
Teddy's doing good. He's sitting right beside me, just chewing on his toy, and he's doing him.
I feel like we've made so much progress from, you know, back in the day where you had to keep yourself on mute all the time because Teddy was either biting you or barking. Now we can just chill, post up, and be part of the episode.
Yeah, until he wants to go outside, and then he won't.
And then you got to go outside. Yeah, it's practice for the real thing. I understand. JR understands. JR, before we get to Yinka, what was that all about, and how did that go? You in there with a bunch of, was it 3-year-olds today?
Yeah, so my niece turned 3 today, and I had to chaperone a birthday party. She loves her Uncle Jordan, so she wanted me to be there. It was a lot of fun, though. Very energetic. I actually end up having fun. You know, you always get to relive your childhood whenever you have or chaperone those little birthday parties. I ended up getting in the little bouncy house and jumping with her. So
it was a good time. I can only imagine. What'd you get her for her birthday, though?
You chaperone her party? No.
Like, she cares about that.
She's already a girly girl, so she, like, loves clothes and shoes. She loves dresses.
Did you get her some J's?
No, she's not. She's a girly girl. Like, she
But she don't mean she can't wear J's.
She likes boots and sandals and stuff like that.
Okay. All right. And Saxy Prince, my bad. You know, we kind of skipped over you. So we're coming back. Saxy Prince, man, how you doing? And how many days have gone by since Black Panther has come out that you have not gone to see the movie?
Well, so basically from Thursday, the day that it came out, until Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, watched it every single day for those 4 days, haven't seen it since then. My mom texted me on Wednesday, said she wanted to go see it again, so I'll probably end up going seeing that again. Just had a phone conversation with my older brother. He wants to go have the three brothers go see it, so we might see it again. So, I mean, I might end up seeing this movie 6 times by the time everything's all said and done.
Prince is about to give them all his money.
All the coins. He about to send Ryan Coogler and them all the movie tickets and be like, yo, let me in the next one.
Exactly. That's what I'm.
I supported the first one. Let me get in the next one.
I've been studying. I've been watching the film.
Yeah, we have to hear your Wakandan accent at some point here. Make sure that you can actually fit in because you know Chadwick.
Don't do that.
When Chadwick does his episode, like he's all the way when he gets that accent on. He's all the way in. It is quite believable. But since you know, you've been pressing us on this for a little while here. We'll start the timer, but Prince, you get to start us off. You know, when JR and I were here, kind of holding things down when y'all were gone, we talked a little bit about everyone going to see the movie. Everyone has seen it now. So, Prince, get us going. I know you posted some things on Twitter. What were your thoughts on the movie? How many of the 1,000 think pieces that have been written since the movie came out have you read? And just generally speaking, did it live up to your expectations?
To answer that final question, I think it far exceeded my expectations. I've tried to search high and low for every think piece just because I wanted to see all like the cultural symbolism as well as this, you know, little societal tools that they used, some of the stereotypes that they did such a good job deconstructing. So like I said, I think it did a good job just exceeding my expectations because this didn't necessarily feel like a Marvel film. This felt like, a film that just happened to have superheroes and, you know, some of those, you know, similar you know, themes that are used within superhero movies, but it definitely was a lot deeper than that. I think you saw one of the biggest things you saw is like the cultural clash that is African versus African American, and that's actually something that I, you know, me and my brothers have had to go throughout our lives, just being, you know, second generation Nigerian children, being born in America. So we got to see both sides of that, both sides of those cultures kind of playing at each other a little bit. And you saw it in the main characters, T'Challa, and you also saw it in Killmonger as well, too. I think the movie music was just really well done, that further played on that theme that I just mentioned. Obviously, the way that the women were depicted was a huge thing for me. I got to see women in a way that I've wanted them to see portrayed, not just in superhero movies, but in films in general. Two of the strongest characters in the movies were very much... you know, I don't need a man to make me happy, and I'm just going to focus on my career goals, and I'm going to focus on things that are important to me. But it did let me know that I need to step my game up as far as being a prince, because, you know, T'Challa was a prince, and he couldn't get his ex-girlfriend to stay with him until he became king. So I got a lot of work that I need to do throughout that time. But overall, I gave it a 9.5 out of 10. I think the movie's just really well done. I think it gets better as you keep seeing the movie over and over again. You catch things that you didn't see in the first time. There was just so much attention to detail. And definitely a film that's just unlike any other Marvel film, just because it didn't feel like a Marvel film.
Yeah, but what's that 0.5 that's missing from making the 10?
You know, they're...
I think his parents are immigrants, you know. They ain't no 100%. That's the African piece that Yankee was talking about at the beginning right there. You ain't getting
no 100%. It's not a perfect film. There were definitely some subtle plot holes that were there, as well as, you know, again, you guys say I am African, so listening to the accents, some of the accents were a little bit inconsistent throughout the film. I know Forrest Whitaker got roasted, obviously, on Twitter just because of his attempt at accents. So obviously, there's just a lot of there were some issues over there, but the issues weren't big enough where it, for me, was such a huge drawback for the movie, because I more often than not, I understood why that choice was made there for whatever reason. And then I guess my last point is, this was one of the first films that I've seen, superhero films, where two things. Marvel has done a really good job with finally kind of breaking away from the curse of the issues that they have with their villains that are just ruled by vengeance and more power and all this stuff, where you can actually sympathize with the cause and, you know, just where the villain is actually coming from. So you almost root for him at various points within the film. So I just think that was extremely well done, and it helped propel the movie forward throughout the entire film.
Okay, Miles. How many times have you seen it, and what were your thoughts about the movie?
I've only seen it once. I thought it was phenomenal. I know. I will go see it again, though, for sure. I just haven't yet. But it was a great movie. I loved every second of it. I was laughing. It was... You know, I was laughing at the funny parts. The serious parts were, you know, you're sitting at the edge of your seat. I loved it. Can I go on a quick little mini rant?
Go ahead.
Do it.
So,
Yinka did that and ended up being 20 minutes on one show. So, you know,
mine'll be like two. I think it's the whole African and African American side of things. Like to me, the definition of African American is what Yinka is explaining. Is the fact that him and his parents are like second generation and generational Africans. They're from Africa, but they're in America now, so they're African Americans. But black people born and raised, grew up here, don't really have like known descendants from Africa. I think the idea of like calling every black person African American just is a flaw in my notion of it. I don't know. Maybe I'm just nitpicking here, but just like Yinka and his 0.5, you know, instead of a 10. But
I mean, we're black.
Hold on real quick. You don't call white people European Americans, you know, Irish Americans. You don't get to that level with all these people, Asian Americans, a lot of times are just called Asian. Like a lot of these nuances and stuff. Like I've never understood the African American. Like I know people are trying to be politically correct, I guess, or I don't know what it is, but I just don't understand it because it's not politically correct. So
allow me to, I guess, further kind of clarify what I mean when I say African American versus African. So as you guys know, my parents, born and raised in Nigeria, they came over to America. They would consider themselves Nigerian more so than anything. They wouldn't consider themselves Nigerian American at all. Like they're Nigerians. That's the culture that they love. They embrace all that stuff. Me and my brothers was a little bit different, whereas we were born more Nigerian American, where we were raised, obviously, the customs and the culture that is being Nigerian, but we were also surrounded with fellow Americans and whatnot. So I learned to be American that way. But there was obviously internal and kind of external struggle between being Nigerian and then also being American, in which both sides at some points wanted to kind of pull us in either which direction, in which we couldn't really say like, hey, we want to be this, because my brothers and I don't speak Yoruba, which is one of the dialects in Nigeria. But at the same time, our names are Ni, Kunle, and Yinka, which obviously if you ask any American, they, you know, won't say that that's an American given name whatsoever. So when I say African American, I guess I'm more saying black in that aspect, but I'm also saying African American in the sense of, you know, like how I am, where I am kind of pulled between being African and American.
Right, that's kind of what I'm getting at, though. It's like I view you as like the definition of what African American is. Like you're, you know, first generation, or second, or yeah.
Yeah. So let me just to hop in real quick. So part of the reason that like the term African American was coined to begin with is, you know, back in the day, like we consider ourselves black people. You know, most black people just call other black people, but like, you know, coming up out of the civil rights movement and all that stuff, most of the things that referred to black people, like colored and all of that other stuff, had very negative overtones to them. And there were, you know, hella lawsuits for people being sued for things, you know, person of color, Negro, all that kind of stuff that was going on. And so part of the kind of the trailing edge of the civil rights movement kind of pushed for the term African-American to come in, because back in the 60s and the 50s and all that stuff, Irish people were referred to as Irish Americans. Germans were referred to as German Americans, et cetera, et cetera. And so African American was just a way to capture all black people who lived in America and have a name for us that wasn't about us being black necessarily. It was about where we were from. And so that's where that came into play. As for the rest of it, you know, I feel you on that. Again, I feel like it's maybe at this point, you know, politically correctness gone maybe a bit too far, because at the end of the day, most black people just call black people, but that's the basis and why that came into being in the first place, was kind of a step away from all the names about black people being referred to their color. Whereas, like you said, other ethnic groups, when they come to America, it's not like, hey, it's, you know, the white immigrant or the whatever, you know, so
European American, Jason.
Yeah, people wanted to step away from something that was like just about, you know, the color of skin and more about, you know, the origin of the people.
And right. and with that point, is the funny thing is I've had enough Nigerian people tell me, but until they came to America, they didn't know what being called black was. They didn't know any of that stuff. They didn't, like, all they knew was a person who was like white, obviously, it was because all I saw on television was either people that looked like them or a white person, right? So they never knew within themselves to identify as black. You know, they just identified by their, your last name, houses, all that stuff. It wasn't until they came here that they needed a way to identify themselves and their children subsequently down the road on how to say it. So they'd never really learned the term black until much, much later. They learned, their children learned the term African-American. And I guess within this is, you know, I obviously use both black and I use African-American, but as it relates to, you know, certain parts of my identity, I still use African American just because, like, or even Nigerian American, just because that's such a, That's just a way I identify, and it's a way that it helps explain
it's accurate.
You know, some of the things that I, yeah, that I don't.
Culturally, yeah. It's accurate for you.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
All right. My bad. Let's go back.
That's all right. You know, you had some things. We got them out here, and we still got to get, you know, JR's review of the film, which feels like, you know, we were talking about the movie like ages ago, but we got to get JR back in here because JR actually went to see a movie. First question is, how much film did you watch while you were in the movie, JR, or did you actually watch the whole movie?
I actually watched the whole movie, and I thought it was very good. And y'all know I'm not a big movie guy or a big movie historian or anything like that, but overall, I thought it was really good. I thought they did a good job of mixing action and humor, and it wasn't one of those movies where you felt like it was really long and there was a lot of empty spurts in between it. There was action throughout the movie. It started off a little bit slow, but it picked up as it went on, and it was just really good after you got like 10 to 15 minutes into it. But overall, I give it an A+. And y'all know I'm not a big movie person at all, but I thought it was really, really well thought out and really well put together. I hate, man, my man Forrest Whitaker. I think his name was Zuri. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right.
His name is Zuri. Yep.
Man, he died like Samuel L. in Deep Blue Sea, man. Unexpectedly. I hate he had to die like that, man.
Why you got to bring up Deep Blue Sea, though? You know, we just got Yink over here on a rant on Black Panther. You know how Yink gets when we talk about Deep Blue Sea, man.
Man, I said that like a month or two ago. People are just like, no, it's all cool. I'm like, come on, man. That was... Going to sat me all like that.
You see what you did, JR? All right.
Forrest Whitaker had to die like that, man.
It's true. It was the he just had to keep his mouth shut. Definitely. He really just had to keep his mouth shut. Well, we took a little bit of extra time on this segment, but we're still gonna get to this last question. So we're gonna do this rapid fire. JR, starting with you. What NFL player do you think is most likely to have a secret life as a superhero?
It's got to be Cam Newton, right? That's got to be everybody's selection. I mean, it's Superman, the guy that everybody sees is superhuman. His nickname is Superman, like I just alluded to. So it has to be Cam Newton. He's a guy that the Carolina Panthers heavily rely on, especially their offense. The offense goes through him. Everything revolves around Cam Newton. He is that franchise. So I think Cam Newton would have to be that guy.
Okay. Miles, which wide receiver? No. So which NFL player do you think is most likely to have a secret life as a superhero?
Yeah. Man, I don't know. I feel like there's got to be a few because there's like so many of these guys. Like, who's a guy that like doesn't look like he'd be an athlete? So he's got that like Clark Kent to him. But then the second he steps on the field, he's Superman.
Don't do it, Yinka.
What'd I do?
I feel like there's a lot of guys, so I don't even know. I can't pinpoint it, but
so no answer from you, Miles?
I no answer from me. Oh, I'll come back to it. Terrible. Oh no. All right. Odell Beckham Jr., Spider-Man.
All right, we'll take it. Yep, with the hands. Saxy Prince, you only get one answer because I feel like you got two or three ready to go. You get one answer. NFL player, secret life is a superhero.
And you get 30 seconds.
I actually think I'd probably go with Marcus Sherrills. We've kind of asked ourselves time to time again how Marcus Sherrills keeps making the team, and I think I'm convinced of it. He's probably at some point saved one of the Wilfs, like distant cousins or something like that, and he keeps putting in a good word. So Marcus Sherrills just leads that double life, and that's what keeps him on the team.
Wow, that's amazing! Like that's probably the best work you've done in bringing it back to like a homegrown Minnesotan. An episode. Marcus Sherrill's the superhero. Impressive. All right. Let's get into it. We're going to talk some actual football today. Some things that we need to hash out, get to the bottom of here. And we had a little discussion, you know, in our group chat here about, you know, wide receiving groups and how you'd want your receiver core to be set up. And so we're going to talk about it because, you know, we were going back and forth there. People were typing some stuff, but I need some people to help me understand their position. So here's how it was laid out. I asked the question, would you rather have a receiving core of Stephon Diggs, Adam Thielen, and let's say a Paul Richardson? Or would you rather have a receiving core of Julio, Mohamed Sanu, and we'll say they still have Taylor Gabriel? And then just to, you know, mix things up a little bit, we're going to add another one in. And you know, we'll say Antonio Brown, Juju, and Martavis. when you're looking at, you know, setting up your receiver core, which one of those groups is most appealing to you and why? And, you know, JR, you were the first to take yourself off mute, so I feel like you got something to say. Lead us off.
Well, I'm big on having that lead dog in the receiving core because I'm a firm believer in it's a superstar-driven league. That's what the NFL is. It's driven by star players at every position, especially quarterback, running back. Well, I won't say running back. Let me back up. Quarterback and receiver, especially. When you have a lead dog in that category, that really separates you, especially during games. So I always want that top dog or that alpha dog who I can go to, whether to separate in a game or when times get hard. So you talk about guys like Antonio Brown, Julio Jones, AJ Green, Odell Beckham, DeAndre Hopkins. I can count on pushing the ball to those guys at any moment in time. I know that any point in the game that I can rely on them to go up and make a play. And that's what I'm big on at the receiving core position or at the receiving position. I always want that top dog. I would rather have that top dog than three other guys that, you know, can get open because – I'm not sure if they can break a game open like that top dog can. I love Adam Thielen and Stephon Diggs, but I don't think they're the type of receivers that can completely take over a game or dominate a game and score no matter what position we're at on the field like an Antonio Brown can or Odell Beckham can or even a Julio Jones can. So that's where I stand in the argument.
Okay, so the options that I laid out for you there, you know, the Vikings, the hypothetical Vikings roster is knocked out there. So now you got – you know, Julio Jones plus some people or Antonio Brown, Juju, who's pretty good, Martavis, who can be good. We know that you tend to be partial to Julio Jones. Which of those groups are you rolling with? Because, you know, Antonio and Julio, they're both top dogs. Which way are you going with it? Because it seems like the Steelers might be a little deeper.
Yeah, Steelers by far. You talk about Juju, who's has a sky high ceiling. Antonio Brown, we know he's a top dog. And then you have Martavis, who can break open a game at any moment in time as well. So those three guys are probably the top trio in the league, I would think so. And then all three of those guys are unguardable in any situation. And then we all know how big-time Antonio Brown is. He could take over a game at any moment. And, I mean, even a guy like Juju, he provides value on special teams as well. So that probably is the top trio in the league. But as I alluded to before, they have that top dog at their receiving core. And that's Antonio Brown. So I definitely would pick the Steelers.
Okay. Mr. Wide Receiver, Miles Gorham.
Well, so you threw me off because you didn't have the Steelers one in the scenario when we first talked about this. So
I feel like we probably are all going to agree that so the Steelers are the top dogs there because they have, you know, 1A and the other ones. So let's move them out. Go back to the original discussion. Diggs, Thielen, Paul Richardson versus Julio, Sanu, Taylor Gabriel. JR's already laid his case down. Yep. Regardless, he wants top dog, wide receiver one, Julio
Jones. And then whoever with him.
Whoever else. He wants that guy who can take over the game. What is your counterpoint?
See, I'm going in this scenario, if you get rid of the Steelers trio, I'm going Diggs, Thielen, and you know, in your case, Paul Richardson, because I think you add two number one, you know, they're like right on that fringe of, you know, number one / number two receivers, but together they're like the best combo in the league. And Diggs and Thielen. And so you can't double team both of them, or you could, but then that leaves guys like Paul Richardson open who can burn you deep with his speed and his catch radius. So where I look at it is you don't have one guy to focus on. You have to game plan against two to three guys instead of just one. And I know how great Julio is, but what we've seen over him the last few seasons and a lot of his career is he's not a big touchdown scorer. He can score touchdowns, but they don't, at least I don't know why they don't give him more opportunities to score touchdowns, but he's not like the double-digit touchdown scoring type of guy anyways. At least he hasn't been up to this point in the league. But you get guys like Diggs and Thielen who can win in the red zone. They can win one-on-one. You know, like I said before, basically de facto wide receiver ones, like both of them on one team. They're not at that same elite level individually as a Julio Jones, but I think together you kind of have a little bit of that. So you can't double, triple team both of them. So you have to kind of prioritize one, or you got to leave them one-on-one, and you can't guard those guys one-on-one. So I think, and then like I said, you throw in a Paul Richardson who's going up against a third DB, and he's burning that guy all day. So I'm going that route because I just think those guys will just create so many mismatches. They can move those guys around. You could do so many different things so a defense can't really game plan against one of them. It's, you know, both or all three of those guys in that scenario. With the Falcons, you got Julio, who obviously is going to get double, triple teamed, because you're not as worried about a guy like Mohamed Sanu or Taylor Gabriel to like beat you. Those guys might make some nice catches, make some plays, but those guys aren't going to win the Falcons games. So that's where I kind of differ on that scenario. Is those guys aren't going to win you games, but with the Vikings, you all three collectively, you can't guard those guys one on one. But with the Falcons, you know you can leave Mohamed Sanu and Taylor Gabriel on an island while you double or triple team Julio Jones. And it doesn't mean Julio won't always make those plays, because he makes quite a bit of them. But I think, you know, triple teaming him is, you know, a better win for the defense. So that's just my opinion.
Okay. Prince, as often seems to be the case, you are the decider here. You are the deciding vote. Which way are you going with it? You going with the Julio Jones and some dudes, or are you going with Stephon Diggs, Adam Thielen, and Paul Richardson? Also, are you going to take yourself off mute so everyone can hear what you're saying?
Yeah, oh. I will. Thank you for reminding me. I was actually really leaning towards what Miles was saying as far as going with, you know, Stephon Diggs and Adam Thielen. But then I thought to myself, like, it is so great to obviously have, you know, two really top 10 wide receiver type guys, or top 12, whatever the case is, you know, consistently. But then, you know, like him and JR's, like, it is a star-driven league, and Julio can do things that Stephon Diggs and Adam Thielen can't. Because in order for, you know, Stephon Diggs and Adam Thielen to really succeed, you're obviously worried, like, okay, well, who do you stop? You roll coverage over to one, and the other one's going to thrive. But the issue with Julio Jones is, like, it almost sometimes doesn't matter how much coverage you roll over to him, because he's more often than not going to win. And I think that sometimes supersedes the fact that, yeah, you have two consistent guys all the time, but they can never really achieve that top echelon of play that you might need in crunch time versus, you know, Julio Jones and, you know, maybe really a guy who's not very, very far away from him. You know, bringing all that coverage over, you know, the other guy can, you know, win more often than not. So I feel like I'm going to go towards the Julio Jones and Mohamed Sanu route.
Don't talk to me the rest of the pod.
Wow. Wow. That is surprising from Prince.
Right? Your turn, Jason.
Yeah.
No, Prince decided. I'm just going to throw out, you know, if we're looking at things here, you know, Pro Football Focus wide receiver rating for last season. If you're going with the route that Miles would want you to go, you'd have the number 7 wide receiver in wide receiver rating, Stephon Diggs. So quarterbacks had a rating of 120.4 when targeting Mr. Diggs. You'd also have number 19, Adam Thielen, at 104.4. And number 20, Paul Richardson, at 104.3. It's not too shabby. Surprisingly, but not that surprisingly, based on some of the points that Miles raised there, our man Julio Jones, because of the volatility of touchdowns, not in the top 40 in a passer rating too, because he didn't score very many touchdowns. Julio's number 1 in yards per route run, which is a bit more predictive of a stat, but passer rating too. Julio didn't score many touchdowns, so he's not in that top league. I'm not
his
voting.
His OC sucked. His offensive coordinator was terrible.
We know this. So, and this one, Miles, you know, you got to talk to the boys, get them on your side, keep lobbying them to have a more well-rounded wide receiver core. I roll with you on this one. But in this case, you know, JR and Yinka, they outvoted you. So they take this one.
Real quick, I know we talk about Julio's offensive coordinators, but the numbers he put up this year are pretty comparable to what he's done his whole career. He's scored more than 10 touchdowns once in his career. Otherwise, he's averaged about 5 or 6. So,
oh,
you're getting double teamed.
That's what I said. Yes, thank you. Exactly. That's why you go with the other guys, because they don't get double teamed.
I'll set the trap for you, JR.
Man, I'm not taking Diggs and Thielen over no damn Julio Jones.
Oh, boy. Well, let's talk about something else that I'm sure we are going to agree about here. And because it's a topic that's near and dear to Yinka's heart, I'm going to start with JR on this one. JR, define franchise quarterback. What does that mean? Because we throw that term around a lot. And the reason we're having this conversation, as opposed to some of the other conversations that are out there, is that I feel like the conversation about, you know, Kirk Cousins or Case Keenum or Teddy Bridgewater or Sam Bradford and just who do you like better and all of those things has kind of been beaten to death. And what you hear a lot is that, you know, Kirk Cousins can come in and give us stability at quarterback position to be a franchise QB. People rarely actually define what they mean when they say franchise quarterback. So, because so many people have different definitions, I figured I would talk to y'all and let each of you tell me what that means. And then, you know, we can maybe try to put some traits to it and see if over the course of the next few episodes, maybe we can start to get a map of, you know, which of these quarterbacks actually would be the best one for us to take. So, JR, franchise quarterback, what does that mean to you?
Yeah. So it's a fine line between the two, but well, what I mean by the two is what I consider a franchise quarterback is an elite quarterback. I think that's the same thing for me. What I consider an elite quarterback, a guy that's in that top 5 to 7 range at the position. And what I always say is, can that guy, no matter who he has around him, I don't care if it's Jeff Janison, and Moritz Boehringer, if he has those guys around him, is he still able to elevate their play? If he is able to do that, then I think he is a franchise elite type of quarterback. No matter the circumstances, who he has around him, the talent he has around him, is he still able to elevate them and play at an above average level? And that's where you talk about guys like the Aaron Rodgers, Drew Brees, and guys of that sort, Ben Roethlisberger, Tom Brady, guys along that line, because no matter who's out there on that field with them, it doesn't matter who's out there with them, they're able to elevate the play of those other guys. That's what I categorize as a franchise quarterback. Now, there's a lot of other definitions out there that people use, but that's just my personal.
Okay. All right. All right. Miles, how about you, man? When you say franchise quarterback, what do you mean? What are you talking about? Is it that top tier, or is it something else?
He's got to throw to, you know, one receiver every time, the whole time. So, for me, I think Jared hit it on the head. I mean, for a franchise quarterback, like, you have to be the type of quarterback that elevates your offense. You can't just plug in people to any offense because of a coordinator of the surroundings. I'm not trying to subtweet, you know, any players here, but like, this is just kind of how I feel about it. Like, you create your own situations. You create your own, you basically create your own offense in the sense that, like, it doesn't matter if it's a coordinator. It doesn't matter if it's your receivers. You kind of, like JR said, you elevate the players around you to perform at a higher level than what they're probably really at. So that's the kind of quarterback I'm looking for in a franchise quarterback, a guy that's going to elevate the Jeff Janises of the world and the Jordy Nelsons, I said it, of the world. They're going to make these guys look a lot better when they're playing the position than when they're not. So
Miles' cousin's about to be mad at him. Yinka.
Yeah, man. Let's move on quick, right?
Franchise QB. What's it mean to you?
I kind of wrote down three things. I think the confidence is one of them. And I don't necessarily mean like quarterback, just the quarterback confidence, but I think the confidence that the players around the organization, all that stuff has in that player. I think that's why just to talk specifically about us, why you hear about Teddy Bridgewater so often. But I think confidence versus likability, I think those two terms are kind of getting mixed up when we're talking about like Teddy, a lot of people say, oh, he's so likable. But I think it's more, I think it's being sometimes confused with, I think a lot of people have a lot of confidence in him as the franchise quarterback. But the reason why I brought up those two is I think that's the reason why when you look at someone like Aaron Rodgers, I don't know necessarily if he has if everyone in that organization and on the team likes him, but I think they all have the confidence that he's always going to, like you guys have said before, is always elevate his play to always give Green Bay a chance. So that was one of them. I think you guys touched on it, like obviously the consistency aspect of it, the consistency of like performing in the stats that are like really highly correlated with winning. I think that's really, really important. I don't necessarily think it has to be elite. And when I say elite, like top five all the time, but I do think that you do need to hover at least that 10, 9, 8 range consistently and not necessarily get like JR and Miles have both said, not necessarily get affected by the change that happens around them. You know, maybe losing a stud wide receiver, offensive coordinator, play calling, scheme, all that stuff. And then the last thing would probably just say, you know, that clutch gene, you know, that how do you perform in those high pressure situations? The third down and longs, the red zone, you know, late in fourth quarter, all that stuff. So those are kind of like my three, like, I think this guy can be a franchise quarterback versus no, I don't think he can be.
All right. I like those. And JR, you know, we're basically stealing your list. So Yinka touched on some of the ones that you kind of you put out in a tweet. I think it was back in December that you shared with us again today. I guess from your perspective, you've kind of told us what it means to be a franchise QB. Basically, they need to be, you know, elite, kind of top level, top tier, can elevate the people around them. I guess thinking about it from that perspective, what are the traits that you're looking at, or what goes into making that franchise quarterback? And I think you listed 10 things, and I think Yinka probably hit on three of them right there.
Yeah, so I'll just go back over it. The number one thing I look for in quarterbacks is confidence. And that's something, as an outsider, you can't really tell exactly how confident a guy is unless they exuberate it. A guy like a Baker Mayfield is a prime example of that. He's a guy that exuberates confidence, and not only himself, but it feeds off his team as well. But unless you're working with a guy day to day, you really won't know exactly how confident he is on and off the field. So if a guy is not confident, though, I don't want any parts of him as a quarterback, because you're the guy that represents not only yourself, but you represent that organization. And if you're not confident, there's nobody that can believe in you. And the one person that your team turns to when you're facing adversity or in tough times during the game is the quarterback. And if he's not confident in himself, there's no way you can feed off your teammates, or how can the coaching staff be confident in you if you're able to come back in those games or just come out on top of those adverse situations. So confidence is definitely the top thing that I look for. The next thing will be accuracy, because it's something that you can't teach. You can improve it, but you can't vastly improve a quarterback's confidence, because it's just a God-given gift. It's basically kind of like being a deep shooter in basketball. It's not something that you can really develop like a Steph Curry. It's just a God-given gift that he has. The next thing is decision-making. I think that's one of the biggest things for a quarterback. You have to make responsible and precise decisions when you're back there slinging the ball. Mental processing and going through progressions, that's obviously the mental part of the game, is something that's required, especially of professional quarterbacks. Not necessarily saying it's full field reprogression. Some offensive coordinators cut off half of the field for their quarterbacks. It just depends on what is that quarterback's mental capacity. How much can he take as a quarterback? And that's something that coordinators have to figure out when they're working with a quarterback. So mental processing and how fast they can get through progressions is very important. The next thing is footwork. Obviously, that's a very important component, because I'm a firm believer in that quarterbacks are built from the ground up. And one of the first components that you should look for in a quarterback is how good is their footwork, because it really helps with their timing, especially if there's a lot of timing throws in your offense. Footwork is something that is very vital. Now, this is one thing that you cannot teach. It's a God-given gift, and that's poise. There's nothing you can do to teach a quarterback poise. How does he react in the pocket when there's bodies flying around him? Or how does he react when a rusher or a three technique is running directly at him? Does he freeze up and just throw the ball anywhere? Does he stand tall in the pocket, keeps his eyes downfield at his target, follow through, and still deliver? So poise is something that you definitely cannot teach. That's another God-given gift that quarterbacks do have. And the top quarterbacks in the league, that's something that you see that they have. You talk about guys like Aaron Rodgers. Tom Brady is a great example. He probably has the best poise in the league. That leads me into my next point, pocket presence. That's another thing that's naturally born or naturally God-given to quarterbacks. It's just a natural feel of what's going around or what's your natural surroundings in the pocket. Are you able to react to that within the pocket and still keeping your eyes downfield? And like I tell you guys a lot of times with these quarterbacks that's coming into the league, in preseason, you can really tell which quarterback is ready and which quarterback isn't because of their pocket presence. Do they drop their eyes and they look at the rush or the D lineman that's coming at them when they're in the pocket, or do they keep their eyes downfield and anticipate those routes that's going on down the field, standing there and deliver and make a throw? On the next thing is leadership and command. And I mean, that's another thing that you really can't teach a quarterback. You can't teach somebody how to be a leader or be in command. A great story that I was reading about that was from Mitchell Trubisky from the Bears this year. They said when he came in, he was more of a quiet, reserved guy. But, you know, John Fox was telling him, like, look, man, you're the franchise guy. You can't sit here and be reserved and be quiet because guys are going to look up to you. You're the number one or number two overall pick in the draft. Excuse me. You're the face of the franchise. You can't come in here and just be quiet. But now he said a cuss word. Kyle Long said this on the first day of training camp. He actually came in and said a cuss word in the huddle. And that really started making the veterans believe in him because that showed some type of leadership and that he had some type of command. It's the weirdest story ever, but Kyle Long ever since that moment, he's had his respect. The next thing is football IQ. And that's basically just situational awareness and knowing what's going on. Like, do you know how much time is left before halftime? Do you know you're only down 2 points and you need a field goal, or are you down, let's say, 8 points and you need a touchdown and 2-point conversion? Just little things like that, knowing how much time is left on the clock. Football IQ is just situational awareness and mobility. We all know that's a God-given gift as well. Everyone is not blessed to be a mobile quarterback, but is he not a statue back there in the pocket, or is he able to move a little bit around in the pocket? And that's just basically what mobility is. And I broke that down into 10 traits. A little long-winded there, but those are basically the 10 traits that I look for when evaluating quarterbacks.
Okay. All right. I think we're going to try to get into those, have a little bit of fun with them, I guess. But Yinka, you gave us your top ones. I guess, Miles, did JR miss anything? Anything that you'd add to the list that he laid out for us?
No, but I think the only thing I'd say is, like, if you look at, you know, his entire list, what can you not have with, you know, confidence, you know, is the top one, because you can't, you're not really going to get anything else without being confident. So
what I am noticing that's missing from your list, which, you know, it's a bit ironic given a couple of things I think we're going to talk about here, is arm strength. Because every draft season, some quarterback with a really strong arm comes out of nowhere, rises up draft boards, and it happens every year. But you don't have arm strength in your top 10. Help me understand.
Well, it's something that I look for in quarterbacks, but I don't think it's necessarily a huge requirement. And what I mean by that is I would rather have an extremely accurate quarterback over a guy that has just a strong arm, because I think you can get down the field better with a guy that's more accurate as opposed to a guy that's just throwing cannons all over the field and under or overthrowing everybody. And a great example of that, Ashley, is the guy that just got an extension with the Jaguars, Blake Bortles. He's a guy that has a very strong arm vertically, but his accuracy is just not very good. And everything he throws just looks like a knuckleball. And my nickname for him is Tim Wakefield. I'm not sure if y'all know who Tim Wakefield is. He was a knuckleball pitcher for the Red Sox. And you never knew where the ball was going to land, but you knew he was going to strike out that guy. And that's what I call Blake Bortles. You don't know if the ball is going to get there, but you know it's going to be wobbly. And it has a chance of being effective. And that's what you get with Blake Bortles, as opposed to, I don't even want to say it because I know Yinka's going to hop in here, a guy like Teddy Bridgewater. He doesn't have a very strong arm. He's not going to challenge you vertically, but he's a guy that can really kill you in the short to intermediate areas of the field. And just going back to the arm strength argument, I think a lot of times with evaluators, they get so caught up in arm strength because they feel like they can develop those other traits. And what they don't realize is that that quarterback is really lacking all of those other traits. And you take a guy like Josh Allen this draft season, for an example, he doesn't have a lot of those intangibles that I look for, but he does have that one trait that makes scouts salivate over him, which is arm strength. So I think arm strength really blinds a lot of evaluators from really looking into those other intangibles.
So JR, you're right. I was going to kill you for saying what you said. No, not really. What I did want to, what I didn't want to hop in on is it, because we are talking about arm strength, that it's kind of a little bit of a, I guess the way in which we talk about arm strength, because we talk about it in two realms, right? We talk about it in, he has a big arm, or he, again, the term noodle arm kind of comes to it. And I think that's like highly inaccurate, because we've seen a lot of quarterbacks who have, I don't want to say different kinds of arm strength, but they you have seen them be able to do certain things based on what the arm can do. A guy like Sam Bradford, for instance, I think Sam Bradford, regardless of what situation he's in, because of his natural arm strength, can throw the ball in really in any anywhere on the field, no matter what he can do. You see other quarterbacks like, I guess I'm just going to use Teddy Bridgewater for an example, like. He can obviously throw really well outside the numbers, but I mean, there are times where he struggles to throw, you know, some of those like straight line vertical routes, just because because of his arm strength, and B, because of, you know, maybe just not having the feel and anticipation to push the ball down the field. So I guess I'm just trying to get us, not just us, but like the entire community away from just only talking about arm strength in terms of, oh, he has a big arm, he has a little arm. And there's more of like this, like paradigm or spectrum that exists with the amount of like, or the arm strength that does exist with the different kinds of scenarios in which quarterbacks are actually put into. Some quarterbacks can throw better on the run. Some better can throw, you know, more flat footed. So I guess I just wanted to interject that, because I think it's an interesting thing that we talk about.
Yeah. That's fair. We did, you know, Bortles. We talked about the man, and he was one of those quarterbacks who kind of rose up the ranks, you know, kind of through the draft process, was overdrafted, in my opinion, in part because he looked apart, had the big arm. But, and he hasn't played particularly well since he's been in the league. I mean, he's been the brunt of many a joke, but he just got re-signed to an extension. Miles, I want you to hop in here. What are your thoughts on this extension? Because, you know, Twitter, in some circles, have been pretty hard on the Jags, because the numbers that are thrown out there, they seem really big, and Bortles hasn't been very good. So I guess, what are your thoughts on them and what they've done in this particular instance here with, you know, re-signing Blake Bortles, who seems to not have many of the things that, you know, JR said a quarterback should have, and they've locked him up to some seemingly large money.
Yeah, so I personally think it's a good move for Jacksonville, in the sense that Since Blake Bortles was going into the offseason and he got wrist surgery, his fifth-year option that the Jaguars picked up is fully guaranteed, because, you know, if there's an injury. So I think with that wrist injury, they were kind of forced into having to keep him. I'm not 100% sure on that, but that's kind of the feeling I'm getting, based off of the fact that he just got wrist surgery. He waited till the offseason. I think he could have had it earlier than that, but, you know, whatever that is. But what they did with that, though, is they lowered his cap hit by $9 million and made his cap number for 2018 $10 million, which in fact, you know, allows them to go out and add more weapons, you know, go make more other moves. And what it does too is it doesn't mean that they can't go make other moves at quarterback. What it does is it just allows them, so that, you know, let's say they could have gotten rid of Blake Bortles, it means they would have to make the decision before going into free agency, which then you go into the offseason without any, you go into the start of the new league year without any plan at quarterback. So then at that point, you're basically looking to have to make a desperate move, when you already have a guy that, you know, who's still young, you're still developing, you who just helped lead the team to the AFC Championship. You know, he played pretty well down the stretch. You know, he did all those things, and you drafted him, so you want him to be the guy still. So, and you think, you know, he kind of earned that opportunity to at least go into the season either as, you know, the denounced starter, or at least the opportunity to compete to be the starter. So I think what they did was smart. The cap numbers are really average, or, you know, in terms of a starting quarterback for what they're paying him for up to 3 years. So I'm a big fan of it. I think, again, it still allows them to make another move at quarterback if they want to, whether that's a veteran or you know, early in the draft. So they're covering their bases here, because now, like I said before, it allows them to make other moves to either help put more talent, you know, on the offensive side of the ball with, you know, that extra cap space, or, you know, at the same time, it just allows them to not have to make any desperate moves in case they couldn't get a guy like Kirk Cousins, or go get a AJ McCarron or Case Keenum or any of those guys that they might have been looking to target. Now they don't have to go do that. They can at least, you know, still talk to some guys and see what the price points are, but they don't need to make a desperate move. So that's kind of where I look at it. I like it.
I was a little, I wasn't loving the move initially, but then once the details came out, I was like, okay, yeah, it makes sense. Like, where he's at in the value range, again, makes sense based on kind of the fact that he is going to be their starting quarterback, and they're not, you know, married to him over the long term. I think Andrew Brandt tweeted that, you know, with the 50-year option, they were going to have to pay him $19 million for 1 year. Now they owe him 26 over two. So when you look at it, like, kind of in those terms, you know, it makes sense. Low risk move for them. And like JR said, I think earlier today in our group chat, if they do draft someone and that person looks like they're ready to go, because Bortles is tied up, locked up for such a cheap price, he'll have value in trade. So yeah, overall, it's a deal that, you know, at a glance didn't seem great, but yeah, I don't hate it now that I've actually seen the details. I guess, Prince, how do you feel? Because, you know, Blake Bortles is mediocre, and he is a quarterback, and he is getting paid here. And I know that makes you feel some kind of way. But just, you know, based on the economics of it all and how the team protected itself, are you okay with it? Or are you still team stop paying mediocre quarterbacks?
No, I think you said it, Jason, is I was really hesitant about paying Blake Bortles because I did see him as a mediocre quarterback. But you know, the fact that they are making moves to at least protect themselves, kind of both in the short and long term, they can really make whatever moves that they want to. I think Blake has also somewhat established himself, at least for the Jaguars. If they do want to potentially trade him later, they can find a guy that they really do covet. They can still do all that stuff without really hurting their cap. My thing with mediocre quarterbacks is just like they pay mediocre quarterbacks and then you can't even get the weapons to at least make that mediocre quarterback play at a higher level than just mediocre. That's really my biggest issue with those kind of situations. But I think the Jacksonville Jaguars are really in a good position. And I don't really think the Vikings fans should really scoff at the Jaguars, because personally, I do kind of wish we were in that position where we had at least somewhat of an established starter on the roster for sure for this next season. That way we know what we're doing in the future. So I'm with you, Jason. I think this was a good move for them, and I don't think that it limits them to be able to still do some of the things that they might have already wanted to do. So,
okay, and bringing us home on the quarterback conversation, JR, what are your thoughts on it? You know, Blake Bortles, big arm quarterback, not really a franchise guy, but Jacksonville's got him under control for another 3 years. You good with the move, or you feel they should have gone another way?
No, I'm good with the move, and that's why I tell a lot of people you got to wait to see the actual details and the structure of the deal, because if you just look at the numbers, you're definitely going to be unhappy about it. But once I looked at the structure and seen the details of the deal, I thought the Jacksonville Jaguars did a really good job, because it gives them flexibility. And what I mean by that is they can still prioritize a quarterback in 2018 or 2019. So let's say they want to take a guy like a Mason Rudolph or even a guy like Kyle Lauletta in the mid to late rounds, they still are able to do that. And it basically turns into a developmental guy. But let's say Bortles goes down and one of those guys steps in and has success, now Bortles just becomes an added incentive or another asset that they're able to trade, and then they still have one of those young guys on a rookie deal. And Bortles' contract, a lot of teams will gravitate towards that because it is affordable. And 2 to 3 years down the road, it's really going to be a bargain because it's a lot of money on the back end. But 2020 is a non-guaranteed year for him. So it's a very tradable contract. And I think they did a great job of keeping their options open and leaving themselves some flexibility with the entire situation.
Okay. All right. We're going to do a bonus question because, you know, one of the things you said kind of prompted it earlier in terms of like the strong arm quarterback and kind of why they rise up every year. And I think it ties into this question I want to ask you guys as well, which is running backs. So every year, you know, towards the top of pretty much every person involved with the draft, there's a running back listed as, you know, a top tier talent or the next Adrian Peterson or the second coming of, you know, Marshall Faulk or something like that. And every year, like we have, evaluators, they look at these running backs and tell us that, you know, they're the greatest thing since sliced bread, while at the same time acknowledging that the position in and of itself isn't as valuable, isn't as important to wins and losses. And so I guess I was curious and I wanted to get y'all's perspective on why do we keep ranking these players who play positions that aren't necessarily as important so high on all of our draft rankings every year? And Yanka, I guess, as soon as I said the word running back, you took yourself off mute to let me know you were ready to say some things. So, you know, we'll kick it to you first here and you can let us know, I guess, what are your thoughts on that phenomenon where every year, you know, like Saquon Barkley this year, generational talent, but he plays a position that's not that important. So why is he number one in your draft rankings?
Okay, so let's clarify what you're going to say. So I think we're all on the same page that comparatively speaking, running back is not as important when you're talking in relation to, like, obviously, like a quarterback and stuff. But as far as it exists with, you know, other aspects of football, I mean, running backs and running game in general is still important. So I think that's why they are still ranked at a really, really high level to answer your question. Because because it diminishes the importance of it doesn't mean I think that that importance completely goes away. And I think, again, I still stand by my statement that I think it is a little exaggerated the way that people, you know, talk about running game in and of itself, because I think it is still an important part of, you know, football, you know, as it pertains to, you know, the correlation between, you know, rushing success, you know, for points scored, for instance. I mean, that's roughly around, I think, 4.48 or whatever, which, I mean, it's still pretty statistically significant. Not as statistically significant as, you know, passing game, obviously. But I think that's enough for us to not constantly diminish the importance of the running game. And obviously,
those are two different things. So running game and individual running back are separate discussions. And sure, no one would say that being able to run the football is something that has absolutely no value. It does have value. It's less than the passing game. The point is really that the individual player, the individual component, the individual talent at that position isn't as important as at other positions. So sure, continue to put them at the top of the list?
I mean, I think this kind of comes into the way that we slightly exaggerate that, you know, obviously we know that the running game is important, but, you know, obviously we've kind of shifted to, oh, we should move towards, you know, running back by committee. And I think more and more teams are doing that, but we also don't understand that, or not understand, but we also maybe don't talk about how not every running back by committee is as good as every bell cow that actually exists in the league, you know. I think it is a little exaggerated, not by much, but enough for me to be like, okay, I think I'm not going to go to the extremes yet, because, you know, if you look at the Vikings, for instance, we've been running a running back committee since, you know, 2014 with, you know, Jerick McKinnon and Matt Asiata when Adrian Peterson was out. But I mean, you can even look there. It was very, very clear that, you know, a guy like Jerick McKinnon, who was drafted in the third round, you know, he's a decent running back as it pertains to, you know, within the portion of a running back by committee. But I mean, let's not forget that sometimes these running backs are put into position because of injuries, because of because of the way that the game flow is. Sometimes these running backs are put in position to kind of act as a bell cow. Not always, but that is the case. And we saw that in 2014 when Matt Asiata was thrusting into that, he really wasn't really that great. And we've seen aspects of Jerry McKinnon not really being the greatest starter, but he plays a really significant role within a running back by committee. And I think that's why when people look at it, they have the flexibility to switch over from being running back by committee to being a bell cow, which I think is why some of these are still some of these backs are still coveted.
I mean, they shouldn't be. I mean, Ben Baldwin did the work for us. I mean, just this very week. And when you go back, you know, I think we're going back here to 2004. And running backs drafted in the top 20 going back to 2004 are no better overall when you're looking at yards per carry running the football than all the other running backs that have carried the football in that same time frame. It's almost as if the circumstances are more important than the individual player, which is kind of what we're talking about here. But we've gone back and forth on this about 1,000 times. JR, you are one of those draft people who make rankings. And Saquon Barkley, I'm sure, like everyone else's rankings, he's at the top or close to the top. Even though I think you would also argue he probably shouldn't be drafted anywhere near there if you were running a smart organization. Help me understand the disconnect.
Yeah, so Saquon is actually my number two player. Quentin Nelson is now my number one player in my rankings. But Saquon is still a great player. He's a great prospect. I think the reason why so many people rank running back so high is because it's probably the easiest position to project and one that translates very easily to the NFL. There's no doubt in my mind. If Saquon Barkley or Darius Geis had an NFL game tomorrow or they made their rookie debut tomorrow, that they would go out there and probably be just fine because it's a position that is very easily translatable for prospects. The biggest thing that running backs have to have is vision, and both of those guys clearly do have it. And it's one of those projections that are easy to see on film. And I think what a lot of evaluators gravitate towards is that they fall in love with those running backs because, I mean, it's just such an easy position to see how guys are going to translate. Even a guy like last year, Kareem Hunt, it was easy to see how much his traits would translate to the NFL game. Now, backing up or piggybacking off of that, you know, we always go back and forth as far as what positions provide the most value to a team or even to winning a Super Bowl. When we debated this a couple pies back, the positional value chart. Now, that's where you go and you prioritize those certain positions that you take early. And we all know we have our draft commandments where we don't believe in prioritizing running backs in the first round. And that's not to say that Saquon Barkley won't go in the first round because he's clearly going to be a top 10 pick. But would I take him top 10? I would not. And that goes for the same with Quentin Nelson. I would not take Quentin Nelson that high because we all seen that the money zone or the prioritized range for guards or where you hit on the most with guards is in that second to third or even fourth round range. So there's no reason in taking guys that high. But as you go up the positional value chart, I think quarterbacks was clearly at the top. Of course, you take guys that high. So I think you have to find a common medium in between how you rank guys and positional value chart because there's no sense in taking a running back that high or taking an interior offensive lineman that high when you can get them in the second or third round. But on the flip side, you talk about quarterbacks. That clearly is a prioritized position, and there's no problem with taking them that high because they're such a premium position and they're so rare.
Yeah, and I think that makes a lot of sense. And I think you really nailed on that running back is it's easy to see. Like it's fun to watch the highlights. You can tell when a guy's fast. You can see if a guy has vision. And I think that because it's easy to evaluate those things for running backs, that we might sometimes overvalue them a little bit in that way. I think it's probably also why arm strength from evaluators sometimes gets overvalued, because it's a lot easier to see that a guy can throw the ball 70 yards versus really understanding how well someone's able to diagnose coverage and hit the right guy on, you know, a 7-yard, you know, in route or something like that. you know, the arm strength. Oh my God, he threw the ball from his knees and hit the goalpost from 60 yards away. It's easy to see, right? Like, it's easy to see. Everyone can see that. It's impressive, but it's not really what's important. It's just something that you can see. And I think we sometimes overvalue those things that you can just pick out and see really, really easily. Miles, from your perspective, what are your thoughts on it? I guess running backs. Why is it that every year we fall in love with these guys that I think we know kind of in the back of our minds, you know, really, I mean, they're not the positions that really should be that important. Should we be spending that much time talking about Barkley and guys when, you know, there's other positions, other guys that are probably gonna be more critical to, you know, their teams winning and losing when they get into the league?
Well, I mean, first off, we should probably be talking more about Sony Michel, but, you know, whatever. No, I mean, you know me, I don't believe in running the ball. Why run the ball when you could throw the ball?
This is true. This is true.
No, all right, for real though. What I think is funny though is like funny in like new age offense is like what you're seeing more often too is in the NFL and it stems from college and leaking in the NFL is they're using the pass game as a de facto as like a way to run the ball, like, you know, quick screens, you know, quick slants, you know, crossers, stuff like that. NFL teams are using those on like first and second down as a way to run in a way run the ball. They're easy completions. They're an easy 4, 5, 6 yards, you know. So teams are doing that more often. And I don't know if that's more of a way to, you know, take less stress off your running backs, but that I think that's the biggest aspect of it is taking less stress off the running backs because of how often they're getting hit and they're getting hit hard. So I think like you guys all touched on, when you're watching these, when you're watching running backs, you don't really think about – you're not thinking about their long-term impacts. You're not thinking about their you know, how are they going to be in 4, 5, 6 years. You're thinking, how is this player going to help me day one, you know, in their rookie season? And you, like you guys touched on, you see the highlights. These guys are going to come in and play for me right away. They're going to bring a fast return on an investment. So why would I not go invest on them highly with a high draft pick? But I think where the flaw comes is, like Jason pointed out, a lot of the statistics and everything, you don't need to invest that kind of money and that kind of draft capital on a running back because the stats show that you can get that the same kind of quality return on guys in later rounds, on guys on cheaper contracts, all that kind of stuff, because the running back by committee is becoming more of a popular staple because of how often players get injured. You don't want, when you have a running back carrying the load 20 to 30 times a game, the idea that they're going to stay healthy the entire season is it's an unlikely one. It's not that it won't happen, but the likeliness of it to happen is very low. So Like we've talked about, I'm a big proponent on the running back by committee. I think a lot of these guys, they show that flash coming out of college. They show the early return on investment. So I think, you know, teams feel that, you know, they see the talent on film. I'm going to get that talent to come in and play and impact my offense right away. So why would I not go get him in the top 15 or whatever range it is?
All right. Well, we've covered a lot. One more question. Rapid fire. You get no explanation. You don't get to get into it. You just need to give us your take so we can keep it moving. JR, thin crust, thick crust. Which way are you going with it on your pizza?
Thin, by far.
Okay. Thank you, sir. Miles, where you at, man?
Papa Murphy's Pizza.
What does that mean?
I don't know. I'm just not picky about pizza. So, like, I think it more the style of crust to me depends on where the pizza's coming from.
We need a one word answer. Close your eyes, think of a pizza. Thank crust. Okay. There we go. Saxy Prince, thin crust, thick crust. Where you at? Are you delivering a pizza right now?
What did you say, bro?
I have no idea. Prince is in the car.
Did you just scream thick, bro?
Saxy Prince, Saxy Prince is driving the Uber again. Yeah, we can't hear him.
For real. I said
Dick Chris.
I think you just
I said Dick Chris. Y'all didn't hear me?
Okay. Yeah, no, we heard you. We heard you. Yeah, he gone.
Yeah, heard me? See you, Prince. See you, bro.
Dick Chris.
We got you, man. We got you. All right. Well, we covered everything that we said we were going to cover today. I guess, JR, it is your season. It's draft season. The combine is coming. And any projects on tap? Anything that we should be on the lookout for?
Yeah, I still have my prospect scouting report series going on every 2 days on Viking territory. This Friday, I'll actually be releasing 20 prospects to keep an eye on during the combine. So look out for that.
All right. And I know Miles has been quietly working on some things here. Are we allowed to talk about it yet, or are we waiting until next month?
No, we can. I've been also be posting more gift threads and everything of some of the players I like, and then I'm eventually going to be releasing a top 10 players list.
All right, Saxy Prince, any articles on deck for you?
Yeah, man, I've been kind of like working through a few things.
A Teddy Bridgewater article?
He's a Teddy Bridgewater blogger, so.
Well, yeah, right. I was trying to work on more of like what the Vikings should do, but I mean, I've kind of already done that. But I might give a way too early Vikings depth chart, something that I'll push out. So you might see that in the next coming days or weeks or whatnot.
Okay. Sounds good. Well, gentlemen, as always, thank you for coming on recording this evening. This will probably be the last time we record this week because I'm in Vegas as of Wednesday. So, yeah, if y'all do open up the thing, send it to me. Maybe I'll log in from the streets or something. But
Jason's going to log in. We're going to hear him throwing craps or something like that. And we'll hear in the background.
We'll log in from the floor. So, yeah, send me the invite. I'll see if I can hop on in. But, yeah, gentlemen, it's always a pleasure. And listeners, thank you for sticking with us. My name is Jason Brown. This has been another episode of the Climbing the Pocket podcast. And, yeah, we will talk to you soon. And when I say we, I mean the other people on the podcast, because I'm going to Vegas. We'll holler.